This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of spinal epidural abscess from the spine section on orthobullets.com. A spinal epidural abscess is defined as a collection of pus or inflammatory granulation tissue between the dura mater and surrounding adipose tissue. With respect to the epidemiology, as far as demographics, spinal epidural abscesses are usually seen in adults over 60 years of age. With respect to location, they are usually found dorsal in the thoracolumbar spine. Risk factors include IV drug abuse, immunodeficiency, malignancy, HIV, immunosuppressive medications, and/or a recent spinal procedure. With respect to the pathophysiology, as far as origin of spinal epidural abscesses, hematogenous spread accounts for approximately 50% of cases, and spread from discitis accounts for approximately 33% of cases. With respect to pathogens, Staph aureus is the most common, making up 50 to 65% of cases. Other pathogens include gram-negative infections, such as E. coli, making up 18% of cases, and Pseudomonas is seen in patients with IV drug use. As far as neurologic deficits, 33% of patients with an epidural abscess will have neurologic symptoms. There's a 4 to 22% incidence of permanent paralysis, and this can be caused from direct compression or infarction of the spinal cord blood flow. As far as associated conditions, spinal epidural abscess is often associated with vertebral osteomyelitis and discitis, otherwise known as spondylodiscitis. A spinal epidural abscess is present in approximately 18% of patients with spondylodiscitis. With respect to prognosis, the preoperative degree of neurologic deficits is the most important indicator of clinical outcome. Patients with spinal epidural abscess have a mortality rate of approximately 5%. Early diagnosis is the most essential factor in preventing devastating outcomes. With respect to presentation, patients with a spinal epidural abscess may have a systemic illness that is more profound than patients with vertebral osteomyelitis. Keep in mind that fever is present in approximately 50% of cases. In patients with spinal epidural abscess, pain is often severe and insidious in onset and occurs in approximately 87% of patients. On physical exam, neurologic deficits are present in approximately 33% of cases. Neurologic deficits may present as a radiculopathy or a myelopathy. With respect to labs, the important ones to get are a white blood cell count, an ESR, and a CRP. A white blood cell count in the setting of a spinal epidural abscess has a mean leukocytosis of 22,000 cells per cubic millimeter and is elevated in approximately 42% of patients. The ESR is elevated in greater than 90% of cases, with a mean of 86.3. And finally, the CRP is elevated in 90% of cases. As far as imaging, radiographs are usually normal. CT has poor sensitivity for epidural abscess. A CT myelogram has 90% sensitivity, but is invasive. An MRI with gadolinium is the imaging modality of choice for diagnosis of spinal epidural abscess. MRI with gadolinium shows the extent of the abscess, presence of vertebral osteomyelitis, and allows evaluation of neurologic compression. Gadolinium allows differentiation of pus from cerebrospinal fluid. Keep in mind that a ring-enhancing lesion is pathognomonic for an abscess. An entire spine MRI should be performed to rule out skip epidural abscesses. This can also be used to rule out a concomitant infection outside of the spine. An MRI of the entire spine can also be obtained in cases of delayed presentation, defined as greater than 7 days of symptoms, and/or in cases where the ESR is greater than 95 millimeters per hour. Treatment of a spinal epidural abscess can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative management involves bracing and IV antibiotics. This is indicated for a small abscess with minimal compression on the neural elements and no neurologic deficits, as well as a patient capable of close clinical follow-up. Non-operative management is also indicated for those who are not candidates for surgery due to medical comorbidities. With respect to outcomes, historically the presence of an epidural abscess has been considered a surgical emergency. However, there has been a recent trend towards non-operative management as new studies show non-operative treatment is effective in patients without neurologic deficit. Medical treatment failure is associated with neurologic deficits, which is the strongest predictor of medical treatment failure. Other factors associated with medical treatment failure include diabetes, a CRP of greater than 115 milligrams per liter, a white blood cell count of greater than 12,000 per milliliter, positive blood cultures, age greater than 65 years old, and MRSA infection. Operative options include surgical decompression plus or minus spinal stabilization. The indications include neurologic deficits that are present, evidence of spinal cord compression on imaging studies, persistent infection despite antibiotic therapy, and/or progressive deformity or gross spinal instability. Postoperative antibiotics are indicated for 2 to 4 weeks if there is no bony involvement of the infection, and is indicated for 6 weeks if there is bony involvement. Let's quickly discuss some of these surgical techniques in a bit more detail, specifically decompressive laminectomy, as well as anterior debridement and strut grafting. With respect to decompressive laminectomy, this is the most common form of operative treatment. This is indicated when an abscess is posterior and there is no contiguous spondylodiscitis. Make sure to avoid wide decompression and facetectomy, as it will result in spinal instability. An anterior debridement and strut grafting is indicated when the abscess is located anteriorly. An anterior debridement and strut grafting is indicated when the abscess is located anteriorly, as well as when the anterior vertebral body and discs are involved, for example, in the presence of a spondylodiscitis. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic has been tested on past exams. The first question reads, a 40-year-old woman with a history of intravenous drug abuse and ongoing Staphylococcus aureus septicemia is referred for intractable neck pain with radiation down her arm. She also complains of progressive hand weakness. Examination reveals long track signs in the lower extremities. Her MRI scan shows spondylodiscitis at C5 to C7 with partial destruction of the vertebral bodies and epidural abscess formation. Besides intravenous antibiotics, what is the most appropriate next step in treatment? And the choices are 1. Percutaneous CT-guided aspiration, hard cervical orthosis until bony union. 2. Percutaneous CT-guided aspiration, hard cervical orthosis, repeat aspiration at 6 to 12 weeks, followed by anterior corpectomy and fusion if repeat aspiration is sterile. 3. Anterior cervical debridement and anterior corpectomy without instrumentation. 4. Posterior cervical debridement and instrumented posterior fusion. And 5. Anterior cervical debridement, corpectomy, and fusion, followed by a posterior instrumented stabilization procedure. The correct answer to this question is 5. Anterior cervical debridement, corpectomy, and fusion, followed by a posterior instrumented stabilization procedure. So the patient has spondylodiscitis of C5 to C7 with neurological deficit, acute kyphotic deformity, and anterior prevertebral and epidural abscess. The abscess and necrotic tissue need to be drained via an anterior approach, and the deformity needs to be corrected and stabilized both anteriorly and posteriorly. To quickly review, a spinal epidural abscess is more common in immunodeficient patients and IV drug abusers. They result in vertebral body destruction and instability. In addition to draining the abscess and necrotic bone, the instability has to be addressed by instrumentation and fusion, even in the face of infection. Structural support can include cages with morselized bone graft or structural allograft fixation of anterior and middle column and/or pedicle screw instrumentation of the posterior column. Shausha et al. Reviewed the treatment of cervical spondylodiscitis in 30 patients. They found an epidural abscess in 80% of patients and non-contiguous discitis in 47% of cases. Thus, they recommend MRI of the entire spine in all cases and surgery for intractable neck pain, septicemia, epidural abscess, neurological compromise, gross kyphotic deformity with extensive destruction, and failure of conservative treatment. Hyde et al. Reviewed cervical spondylodiscitis in 20 patients. All cases had postoperative antibiotic therapy for 8 to 12 weeks. At 37 months, with a range of 24 to 63 months, all cases went on to union and there were no recurrences of infection. There was improvement in preoperative neurological status in all cases, leading them to recommend early surgical intervention. Moving on to the next question. A 31-year-old female from the United States who is an active IV drug abuser presents with worsening gait instability for the last 4 days. She has no history of prior international travel. Physical exam shows diffuse weakness in her upper and lower extremities. A sagittal T1 MRI of the spine shows a large anterior epidural abscess at the level of C3/C4. What is the next most appropriate step in management? And the choices are 1. Anterior decompression and fusion. 2. Posterior decompression and fusion. 3. Methylprednisolone loaded at 30 mg per kilogram, followed by drip at 5.4 mg per kilogram per hour drip for 23 hours. 4, broad-spectrum IV antibiotics and bracing, and 5, CT-guided biopsy. The correct answer to this question is 1, anterior decompression infusion. So this patient's clinical presentation is most consistent with spondylodiscitis with an associated epidural abscess in the cervical spine with compression of the thecal sac. The most appropriate next step would be an anterior decompression infusion of the cervical spine as the patient has a neurological deficit prompting surgical decompression. In this case, the epidural abscess is anterior, so an anterior decompression would be most effective. A partial corpectomy will be required, so a fusion will be indicated. The most common pathogen seen in epidural abscesses is Staph aureus. Prophylactic antibiotics should be initiated until intraoperative cultures are reported. Duration of antibiotics usually ranges from 2 to 4 weeks if there is no bony involvement of the infection, or 6 weeks if there is bony involvement. 33% of patients with an epidural abscess will have neurological symptoms, and a large proportion will have permanent paralysis. Hajipavlo et al. Retrospectively reviewed 101 cases of pyogenic spinal infection. Infection elsewhere was the most common predisposing factor. Leukocyte counts were elevated in 42.6% of spondylodiscitis cases. The erythrocyte sedimentation rate was elevated in all cases. Spondylodiscitis is more prone to develop epidural abscesses in the cervical spine than the thoracic or lumbar areas. Tay et al. Review spinal infections. The most common types of spinal infections are hematogenous bacterial or fungal infections, pediatric discitis, epidural abscess, and postoperative infections. Persistent pain and fever are the most common presenting symptoms prior to neurological deficit. And moving on to the final question. A 64-year-old female accountant from Oregon is diagnosed with endocarditis 6 months ago and underwent a course of IV antibiotic treatment. She now reports 3 months of severe low back pain and progressive lower extremity weakness and paresthesias for the past week. Her leukocyte count is normal and she is afebrile. The ESR and CRP are elevated. Radiographs and MRI scans are consistent with extensive destruction of the lumbar spine extending over 3 vertebral segments and associated with an epidural abscess. What is the most appropriate next step in management? And the choices are 1, intrathecal catheter placement with antibiotic administration for 6 weeks, 2, irrigation and debridement, corpectomy, infusion, 3, oral prednisone regimen for 4 weeks, 4, irrigation and debridement via a posterior approach, and 5, initiation of multi-agent antibiotic regimen for tuberculosis for 6 months. The correct answer to this question is 2, irrigation and debridement, corpectomy, and fusion. So the clinical history, physical examination, and imaging is consistent with extensive destruction of the lumbar spine extending over 3 vertebral segments with associated epidural abscess necessitating surgical decompression and fusion. An epidural abscess may present rapidly with neurological compromise. Prognosis improves with prompt decompression, but only 18% of patients with frank abscess and 23% of patients with paralysis completely recover after decompression. Hajipavlo et al. Report in their Level 4 study that leukocyte counts were elevated in 42.6% of spondylodiscitis cases. The erythrocyte sedimentation rate was elevated in all cases of epidural abscess. The article by Harrington et al. States that the surgical indications for an epidural abscess include unsuccessful antibiotic treatment after 6 weeks, vertebral deformity or instability, neurological deficit, MRI showing greater than 50% compression of the thecal sac, and a depressed host immune response. That's all for this review about spinal epidural abscess. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.